This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is a Tuesday, which can only mean one thing: knowledge bank time. That's where we make our intellectual deposits, and you can always send me a suggestion on Lukona at power987.co.za. We unpack papers, books, and fascinatingly, we once unpacked an exhibition as well, and it was such a beautiful one to do. This morning, my guest is Prof. John Lamula. We're going to talk about a documentary history of the church struggle against apartheid between the years 1960 and 1990, and the title is Sowing in Tears. I find that already interesting. And of course, when I think of the church at times, tears are part of it. That's where Giyagutwe Sondelani Nizegumnina and Isindwa Yumitualo Ndiyagunika Kupumla. Prof. Lamula, a good morning with you all the way from the University of Johannesburg's Institute for Intelligent System. Thank you for visiting us and good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, sir. And good morning to the listeners.
Thank you so much for making time. Perhaps I must admit, as I was reading through the preface and intro to the book, I picked up something that we have in similar, both students of the University of Edinburgh. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm seeing a fellow UOE this morning.
Yeah. Well, it was during the dark, rough times. It was not fun. I was there as a student in exile, sponsored by the liberation movement then to study there.
And of course, you had left South Africa already a theologian, a young theologian in your 20s.
Yeah.
How much influence, before you get into the book, how much influence did the church have in you? And because as I read as well, I thought theologian a bit went a little rogue into politics and lost a bit of hope in the church. How much influence did the church have in your activism?
Well, perhaps the church is a secondary effect. The issues of spirituality, I think, emanates from one's own life. I think some time as a very young person, even just a boy, I could sense and smell as I grew up in Potchefstroom, where I was born, that something was wrong, that the town looked so nice, clean, with beautiful lights and shops. And we in the township were living in rickety, growing up in rickety conditions. And just that the natural perception that something is wrong here led to a kind of a conscientization. I remember when I was in what we used to call a JC, I think now is called standard grade.
Those are grades 10 to 12.
Now it's grade 10, yes. In our quasi career development classes, because in Bantu education days, you didn't have a career development class. Our teacher, I think, was just bored, just asked us, what will you want to become when you grow up?
Yeah.
And I said, I thought, I want to become like Archbishop, no, I was not Archbishop then. I said, I want to become like Desmond Tutu. Mm. And in the back of my mind, the reason why I wanted to become like Desmond Tutu, because I was envying the fact that Tutu was able to become, to speak, to be quoted in newspapers and to do activities where he was not harassed, arrested like journalists and other activists were. So that became a kind of a calling and a desire and just the love for reading. I read the Bible, I enjoyed the church, and I was very privileged to be very early on be introduced by to be introduced into, you know, into anti-establishment kind of a Christian reflection. When I moved to Soweto, I was a member of Youth Alive in Dube, where most of us used to to really revel into a kind of a Christianity every Sunday afternoon as youth, under people like Frank Chikane, Ketlam Tembu, Laibon Mabaso, really teaching us to think differently about God and our reality.
Indeed, and it was just not long ago, the Emeritus Archbishop's 90th birthday. So I suppose it's quite interesting that we have this conversation on the back of that.
Yes, indeed. This is a very special, and if I were, I will dedicate this reflection on the life of the Emeritus Archbishop Desmond Tutu, because really the gist of what this book is all about, particularly what is narrated from the time when he was appointed the Dean of Johannesburg in 1975, and how the eruption that occurred in Soweto in 1976 at the back of the of Black consciousness, Black theology, the rise of Black leadership in the church, really Desmond Tutu became the spirit that emanated the development in our history.
In fact, in your own work as a student, you meet him very early on, and you say at the age of 24, that's when you were at UNISA, you were invited to contribute a chapter on the ethics of violent resistance for a special anthology celebrating Desmond Tutu's receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984.
That was very funny. Yes, I was a 30-year student at UNISA.
Yeah.
And I'd written an article. It was an assignment. That is an assignment. And it was in 1984. During that time, within the churches already was a very serious debate about whether it is right for the church to support violence. And violence meant stone throwing, burning Badco buses, etc. Whether should the church support that, or should the church call for peace and reconciliation? We're not even talking about armed struggle then within the church. And I did analysis, and one of the at the stage I was like a field worker for the South African Council of Churches, and one of my bosses, if I may say, Dr. Wolfram Kistner, loved what I've written, and then he encouraged me to develop this into an elaborate essay. And the essay was included when Itumele Mosala and Buti Tlhagale got together to put a book to celebrate Bishop Tutu's receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Yes.
And it is that piece that makes you, when you get to the United Kingdom, to believe that some people had met you, because they would have read some of that work you had put together. But take us through at the time, and possibly now, with your journey through theology, philosophy, and you know, people in philosophy are ever so modest. Even if they are professors, they still call themselves students.
Indeed.
What are your views like from a theological perspective on violence? And I ask this because I've always been curious at the fact that some of the leaders in the struggle, like O.R. Tambo, Albert Luthuli, Chief Albert Luthuli himself, known for his passive resistance, but were confronted with questions of violence in the struggle, but they were devout Christians at the same time.
You see, violence has to be understood within its context. There is a purposeful violence. There is a violence that is the violence that is provoked by the, in this instance, an illegitimate regime that apartheid state or government was, where the state was had declared war on its citizens. But within the actual analysis of violence, we developed a theory then that violence is not only at the point of actual active violence. It goes to where you begin with structural violence. The structural violence of apartheid was isolated. That it is wrong for people to, it was wrong. And even now one could say to a certain degree that structural violence is the violence against the humanity of the people. And where people are attacked, people have a right to defend themselves Now, what the ANC, and I'll talk about the ANC because I knew more about the ANC.
Yes.
Then with the ANC, they developed a philosophy of responsible armed resistance, where it was emphasized that in the reaction must not be apolitical. The reaction must be informed by the goals and the goals and the ethos. First of all, the ethos and the goals. Okay, in theology, they'll say the telos. Why are you doing it?
Yes.
And what is the purpose? Within a political context, that was how it was articulated. And the Chief Albert Dutulu spent the latter part of his life trying to explain to the world why in 1961 the ANC took a decision led by Nelson Mandela to launch Umkhonto weSizwe. And remember when Nelson Mandela them at Lilliesfontein launched Umkhonto weSizwe, it was not a resolution of the ANC. After Nelson Mandela had been out of the country, after they've announced the launch of MK on 16 December 1961, he had to go and plead and get Chief Albert Luthuli as the president to condone that decision. So it was very difficult, like you say, for Luthuli to just support and to, because the ANC didn't want to be seen as a violent organization.
Yes.
Even at the Rivonia trial, which we talk about in the book.
Yes.
When Nelson Mandela had to explain why they had to take the action that they took of going for armed resistance.
Indeed. I mean, talking about structural violence, you're taking me to Johan Galtung's sense of negative peace and positive peace.
Exactly.
And we might get into that. It's 21 minutes past 11. I'm in conversation with Prof. John Lamula on his book. Going to start off after this short ad break on the title itself and a bit of how he stumbled on a series of documents that led to this book becoming a possibility. 21 minutes past 11.
Knowledge Bank.
Indeed, it is the Knowledge Bank. 22 minutes past 11. We are with Prof. John Lamula on his latest book, Sowing in Tears, a documentary history of the church struggle against apartheid between the years 1960 and 1990. Now, Prof, take us through the title and how it came about, Sowing in Tears.
Sowing in Tears, a documentary history of the church struggle against apartheid 1960 to 1990, published by African Perspectives Publishing. Sowing in Tears, when I wrote this, very interestingly, when I started, because the history of the book was, or is that, I stumbled onto a trove of documents when I landed in the UK late 87, which because of the bannings and the repression of literature in South Africa, we're not exposed to, we didn't have. Although I was at that stage a postgraduate theology student, and someone who really read a lot, and we had ways of having access to some of banned literature, I discovered some stuff which in my own self-education thought that this has to be there and be read, and people must understand where we come from. But it was around 1987, 88, and that time the ringing tone or the ringing theme that of this of the title of the book, which comes from a Bible verse which says, "Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy," you know, and then those who continually go forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall surely come again with rejoicing, bringing their sheaves with them, which is Psalm 126. It's a statement of faith. It's a statement of saying, though we are suffering now, after a period of suffering, there shall be a period of harvest. That the tears that are being sowed, that are being shed, are not being shed in vain. But put in the contemporary situation, because I thought this title is still relevant now,
yes,
particularly in a period that we are going through as a people, to remind us that there were tears that were shed at the blood that was flowing through the streets of South Africa throughout the decades, but particularly during the 1970s and 80s. Mm. People were crying at mass funerals. People were crying in the police cells, being tortured, screaming by police, by security branch torturers. Our country has been a country of tears, and most of those tears were tears that were shed in protest, in anger, and in prayer. And the question for me, bringing this into contemporaneity, is to judge the quality of the harvest that we have had out of those tears.
That's very profound. And I mean, looking at those tears at the time, you also, of course, encounter a number of personal experiences. You encounter the what you call a pervasive depression, because though you had managed to escape South Africa, some of your comrades were still held in captivity. And of course, Dulcie September passes on in Paris. In fact, there's just a documentary that has come out on her life and times in Paris, which it's hoped that it will open some investigation, inquest into her the circumstances of her death, and probably bring about justice. But there were other things that were happening, Prof, in the country, and this led to you. And I'm trying to build up, into the significance of this book and how your own political thought, theological thought shifts, because you write your PhD at the University of Edinburgh on the poverty of a theology of the poor, an Althusserian, taken from Louis Althusser, exposure of the philosophical basis of Latin American theology of liberation. You are clearly grappling with the position of the church and how it can be in service of liberation. And of course, we will talk, as you trace in the subsequent prologue chapter, where you talk about how the church, even its language, it doesn't start off as being very much interrogative of the morality, let alone the brutality of the apartheid system. But with time, this evolves. So when you talk about the poverty of a theology of the poor, what are you considering at that time and probably thinking ought to have been the place of the church? You're already in your late 80s, sort of.
Look, in the crucible of the struggle that we're in, Chief, 1984, 85, 86 was a terrible time in South Africa. Okay, you had the Sebokeng massacre, which is not spoken about much. You had 1985, you had a state of emergency in Soweto. There was a Rainbow Court. Police cells were overflowing. Jails were overflowing with activists. It was terrible. The world was screaming at children. There was a thing of children being detained in South Africa, children being shot. There was no school. You had young people from who were just roaming the country, running from the Eastern Cape to Johannesburg. From Johannesburg, people were what we call internal refugees. It was a terrible time. Now, during that time, knowledge was a weapon, and we have identified the church as a site of struggle, and theology as an arsenal in the dismantling of the apartheid regime, in particular, in the delegitimization of its morality. Remember, we had also had the Kairos document at that time, where through the Kairos document, we had declared and gained a general consensus within the thinking community of South Africa that the apartheid regime is a tyranny which has to be overthrown. And the question was how it was be overthrown. So it, within that kind of the heat of that struggle, my sense was to say, was to test theology and theological activism, its efficacy. Is it really correct what's happening? Because what was happening at the end at that stage, because of mass repression, the church has emerged as the leader of the struggle, which was very dangerous from my and how I was taught my yes. underground politics. It was very dangerous that you had these church leaders were seen like that, the ones who were going to negotiate or were going to overthrow the regime. And the question was, if this thing succeets, is Beyers Naudé and Desmond yeah. Tutu and Alain Boussac going to be our leaders? Are we going for a theocracy? Are we going to have something like what they have now in the jihadists in Afghanistan yeah. and so on?
Prof, let's hold that thought. I just have to quickly run to news headlines, but we are going to come back to this idea of who ought to have taken the lead and which influenced you also being involved with some political structures. In fact, 20, it's 11:30. Let's go for news headlines. 0861-987-000 if you want to join the conversation. We'll also unpack some of the key documents that are contained in this book, because it's really an important documentary, just the way it is packaged. But Katla Khodekhodi is standing by.
Speak up. Call the power line on 0861-987-000.
26 minutes to the hour, 12 o'clock. I'm in conversation with Prof. John Lamula on his latest book, Sowing in Tears, a documentary history of the church struggle against apartheid between the years 1960 to 1990. At least that's the focus, of course, of the book and the collected pieces that form part of the book, from statements to speeches to writings of conference outcomes really that make up this book. Prof, you are just wrapping up that point, you know, the possible dangers of a theocracy, the church taking the lead, and you also, you know, confess that you were quite in the black consciousness space. You've counted Rev Chikan, the now late Kehla Mthembu, who have played an influential role in your own political thought. But you were, as much as you were black conscious, plying your trade within the ANC, because you arrived at quite established structures there in London and so on. Then what became, or what... Yeah, what became the role of the church? And you stumbled upon these documents, some of them in Birmingham. You get to these documents, you start reading them, and you realize that, no, there's something of a treasure here. And you get a challenge that, you know, UNESCO might even sponsor you for a book. As far back then, you write this book, you come up with it. Beyers Naudé writes a foreword to the book, but the manuscript goes missing.
Good.
Now, what becomes the role of the church in those moments, or the constructive tension between the church and politics? How do you appreciate it?
Yeah, that's exactly the motif or the theme of the book, of how the interaction between the material conditions and the interpretation of the material condition. Remember, theology is a reflection on what is. Okay? And the what is the lived experiences of the people as organized through institutions of politics and social systems. And at the stage, I was, of course, into a study that really the Louis Althusser there as a Marxist leader, a leading thinker in Marx then from the French Communist Party, was for me very interesting, because he was arguing that the way the Marxism was explained and was applied was wrong, because people had not read or understood Marx at his matured stage. Mm. So what I did, I took that and then I applied that at the Latin American liberation theology.
Yes.
Latin American liberation theology was overtly Marxist.
Yes.
Yeah, they were quoting Marx. They were, some of them published books that Christianity is like communism. They were very advanced, and all of us were getting inspiration from them. Yeah. So my approach was then to ask a question, and a question that really can this thing, which in essence is a theology, it's about God, it's about faith, it's about interpretation, can this be the basis on which a political, solid political movement can be developed? At that stage, we were fascinated in Nicaragua, when the Nicaraguan, the Sandinista revolution conquered.
Yes.
Half of the cabinet ministers there were former priests. Yeah, in other countries throughout Latin America, you had priests taking charge as political leaders, including in Haiti. Lately, you had the priest
and they were targeted in your likes of El Salvador.
El Salvador, yes, exactly.
Chile, they played some roles there.
So we were worried that in South Africa, if we're not careful, we're gonna have that situation. So the idea was to say the politics must be solid, and looking throughout history how that has developed, and if you go through this the documents in this book, you see where the church made some mistakes. You see where the church was part of the culture, the political culture. If you look at the period when the South African Institute of Race Relations, before the emergence of black consciousness in the mid-1960s, all this liberal interpretation of race relations as a problem in South Africa, until it was interrupted by the protests and analysis of black consciousness, and how from black consciousness in the 1980s, after the black consciousness movement was annihilated by the 1977 October 19 burning, how the UDF emerged, and how also the language of the church somehow then became more based on the Freedom Charter, the ANC strategies, the ANC activism, to where we are today.
Absolutely. In fact, you talk about this as almost a historical political narration of sorts, because it's that tension. But I want you to give us a bit of insight in what you observe about the Catholic Church, and you talk about how, you know, some of their statements in the book may be, some people might feel there's discontinuity, but you allude that to how the Catholic Church itself operates and how it usually pronounced through the Conference of Bishops.
Yes.
And it had an observer status in the South African Council of Churches. So that meant it wasn't really a member of the South African Council of Churches, because it still had to protect its own traditions of functioning. But it was, how did its own contribution evolve over time as an observer of the South African Council of Churches and not necessarily bound by the pronouncements of the Council of Churches?
Yes, historically, as you'll know, that from the Reformation in 1521, where you had all these reformed churches that then broke up, you had Anglican, Methodist, etc., the Catholic Church remained solidly. And the Catholic Church protects its integrity and sovereignty within that historicity. But in South Africa, the Catholic Church had its own processes and has its own way of interacting with powers that be. If you go to the Vatican City today, the Vatican City, it's a sovereign state in a way. So a Catholic Archbishop in South Africa, who reports to some cardinals, and the cardinals they have so kind of a governmental structure.
Yes.
The way they deal with matters of
even have ambassadors.
State, they have ambassadors as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a real challenge in South Africa, where you had black Catholics, people like Father Leba Mangsibidi, people like Father Smangaliso Mkatshwa, and others who just from their black experience articulated a theology of liberation, which ironically the Latin American liberation of theology arose from as a challenge of Orthodox mainline historical Catholicism.
Absolutely.
And all of us, even though we're not Catholics, we're feeding from this, people like Gutierrez, the Borff brothers, Leonardo Borff, and others, who were Catholics. So in South Africa, The Catholic Church really did its best under the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference, intervening, giving statements. And one of the most interesting things I discovered, which is in this book, was that in 1986, the Catholic Church was the first of the churches to go to Lusaka, where they met with the leadership of the ANC and issued a statement, a joint statement with Oliver Tambo, that that they believe that with the crisis that South Africa was facing at that time, the ANC articulates the aspirations of the people of South Africa better than the apartheid regime. And therefore, they, as the church, are going to start talking and hearing and engaging the ANC. Remember, coming from the history, I said the statal sovereignty, yes, of the Catholic Church, where the Catholic Church was saying, we want to hear this band organization, we want to talk with this band organization, we want to hear what they think about the future of South Africa. Whether they are banned or not, we are going to defy you, P.W. Botha, with your government, we don't recognize you anymore.
And of course, you would later go to Lusaka in 1987, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, during that time. But they were the pioneers. At that stage, it was very dangerous for the churches to go, for anyone to be, of course, in contact with liberation movements. And following that, like I say, they said, man, the last chapter, which I call Pilgrimages to Lusaka. Everyone started going out to Lusaka.
Business people.
Everyone would say, wanna hear what kind of animals are these possible future leaders. And then in around May 1987, the World Council of Churches organized a conference where they brought all the liberation movements together to Lusaka. PAC, SWAPO, because they had to do Southern Africa, ANC, And then Beyers Naudé, who was then the Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches, organized a delegation to go and meet with the ANC. And I was privileged as a crazy young man to make it into the list of people who
were... To be part of the delegation,
which was an amazing experience. To spend a week with the leadership of the ANC coming from South Africa then, and understanding where things are going, and being allowed to come back to South Africa for a brief time, which of course got some of us into trouble. Hence, I immediately had to leave the country thereafter.
Absolutely. Prof Lamola is my guest. 0861-987-000 is the dial for you this morning as we continue with this knowledge bank, looking at his latest book, Sowing in Tears. Now, Prof, before we go back into the documents that are in the book and, you know, the era of 1960 going forward for the church, which you say signaled the beginning of an identifiable Christian tradition of protest against political oppression and repression in South Africa. Let's talk a bit about just the methodology of compiling this book in the manner in which you did. I mean, you had to go through a lot of a sifting process. I'm sure the documents that you stumbled upon were much more than these, and then sequencing them in a way of telling a story. I mean, you call this a catalogue in one way or the other. I mean, from chapters 1 to chapter 13. And then you guide us by giving us themes to each and every chapter. And you start off with chapter 1, the resurrection. And this is at Sharpeville. The methodology of putting together a catalogue of this nature, where you want to walk us, and you say, even this contemporary piece, you have tried to keep to the, you know, the language of the time in which you compiled this manuscript, but also the manner in which you had envisaged it those 30 years plus back. Why this methodology of compiling a book, almost, you know, making sure that these documents, which would have ordinarily sat in different libraries and different archives, are now archived in one book, but how do you choose the themes?
The first approach or goal was to ensure that the book does not sound like a theological book, that is not for the church, but that the book can be sold in high street bookshops where ordinary South Africans could incipiently also imbibe the history of the struggle written by a black thinker. Because we have lots of the history of South Africa, even as anti-apartheid stories written by people who were the other side of the park. So that was the first thing. So the idea was to give a journalistic but historiographical narration of this is what happens. This is where was in history, and also seek some originality. Put some facts that have not been published before, and the originality come from the fact that as I was in London then, as I had access to some ANC archives, including the ones with at IDAF, International Defence Aid Fund, so I picked up some nuances, the dates, the correlation of events that were not readily available. So that was the fascination, which for me again justified seeking to have the book published. The second was to thematize this, to thematize the collection, the sections into chapters that depict the stages in intellectual development, because it was not just the history, but it was the maturation of radicalness of the church,
the shifts, discontinuities,
exactly.
As well.
And if you look at it from the first page to the last page, you see a crescendo of an awakening church, of an awakening consciousness, and the pillars of this awakening being, for instance, the emergence of black clergy or the self-esteem of black people around the 1970s because of black consciousness movement, demanding leadership in the church, demanding to be the voice of the church. And in the 1980s, the chaos that happened with the ungovernability and the failure of the state being rendered ungovernable. So, and the church becoming overtly radical. I mean, it's a crescendo which ends with a very interesting other originality, is the fact that in February 1988, I think when the regime did its last massive banning of trade unions, and arresting people, putting people like Mama Albert Sisulu and others under the banning orders after they've bombed Kotso House and they've bombed Kosatu House. Yeah. And it was a terrible period. Then they wrote a letter wanting to speak to the regime. Wanting to speak to the SACC, and SACC on the 31st, the clerk wrote a letter asking to talk to the SACC. And on the 31st of January, the SACC said, "No, we are not going to speak to you." But they didn't know that the clerk wanted to consult them and tell them, "By the way, I'm going to go to Parliament.
I have an intention
of making a dramatic announcement."
But they thought he's still up to no good.
Yes, exactly. Which is a crescendo of the book.
Yeah.
And their statement where they say, "Let my people go," addressing refusing to see the clerk.
Absolutely. Yes. Prof. John Lamola is my guest this morning. People of Power, 0861-987-000. Steve, I see you. I'll be back with you after this short break. Prof, before we go to this at break, I've got a question that I would like you to think about. Africa Sebezo says he's enjoying the conversation. He would like to know, what is black theology in the South African context? Let's leave it there.
Tweet Lukhona at Lukhona Mguni and hashtag Power Talk.
Prof Lamola is my guest. Of course, we are talking about the book Sowing in Tears, a documentary history of the church struggle against apartheid, the years 1960 to 1990. Chapter 5 of the book, Prof, Black Consciousness and Black Theology. So Africa Sebezo couldn't have gone wrong by asking, what is black theology in the South African context?
In the South African context, black theology, which of course emerged from the renaissance of black consciousness in the United States, but in South Africa, black consciousness emerged as a theodicy. A theodicy is where someone asks a question. If there is a God, why are we still suffering? Does this God not hear us? Is there something wrong with the way we are? And this is the question that was in the deep reflection of black people in various ways. So black theology emerges as a self-healing, as a self-interpretation that says, no, even there's nothing wrong with being black. Even though we are black, we are also part of God's creation. And what the apartheid regime is doing in turning our blackness as a cause of our inferiorization and the cause of our oppression. In fact, being black means that we have a mission by finding in scripture. Now that sense of social grief leads one to read the Bible differently, where one then identifies with the liberation themes that are there in the book of Exodus, the prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, etc., who were against the injustices of their time. And then rising from that blackness and embracing blackness as a way of interpreting the Bible and the world, and refusing to allow the white theology to define what black people are all about.
Wow. And interesting enough, that chapter starts off with Beyers Nudier's own reflection on black anger and white power in an unreal society, and is really going through the motions of grappling with the material condition before him and what, you know, this means for the church. Do you think, Prof, we have celebrated Beyers Nudier enough and his contributions?
Absolutely not. Coincidentally, I am giving a keynote lecture, the University of Zululand with the Kagiso Trust, on the 19th of October, are having in their series of Beyers Nudier memorial lectures, trying to resuscitate and reposition Beyers Nudier. Beyers Nudier was very critical. First of all, in the sense of his natural location, if I can use existentialist language, yes, as a white person who was an Afrikaner, born in the 19 whatever, his consciousness started in the late 1950s, yeah, where he rejected the privileges of being a leading Afrikaner theologian. And from 1963 until the SACC was formed in 1968, in fact, until Desmond Tutu took over the SACC in 1978, until then, the voice of the church in South Africa was led by the Christian Institute, which Beyers Nudier founded in 1963. And Beyers Nudier was the first white person to engage seriously with Steve Biko, Barney Pichana, and all that movement of young people who were rising in the around that time, talking about black consciousness.
Okay, Prof, let's just quickly run to the lines. I've got Steven. Steve Libelo, good morning.
Hi, Lukwane, and hi to your guests. And two quick ones. My first concern here is that this is an opportunity to reflect on, you know, the status of violence in the liberation struggle, particularly in the period under consideration, 60 to 90. At the very beginning of the period, you have two types of violence, you know, which are being thought about and actually being carried out. On the one hand, you have the sabotage campaign carried out by the, you know, by MK as it was established. The target here being, as they, you know, refer to it, you know, the kind of infrastructure that keeps the capitalist system running. So the target here would have been, you know, your installations, key installations that kept the South African economy running. That was on the one side, you know, and that was the understanding of that violence. But, you know, at the same time, between 61 and 62, you had a different kind of violence, you know, which was carried out by Potlo in what became the Potlo insurrection of 61 to 62. The most graphic example of this would have been the attack at Bashir River in 1961. You know, that wiped out an entire family. Now, that in itself, you know, raises serious questions about what our understanding of violence in political or liberation struggle is. Okay. If you fast forward to 76.
Steve, let's wrap up.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just leave it at that. Let me just say, what then becomes the ethical and moral, you know, understanding of what violence should do for that violence to get ethical validation,
okay,
you know, by the church.
Okay, Steve, got you. Stephen, a quick one from you.
Okay, quick one. I just wanted to find out, Dr. Isaac Becker and Reverend Chikano combined the two group of church, the white churches, AFM churches, and the black one. Did it have any impact or any impact on understanding the Christianity or the churches in South Africa? Was it there an attempt actually to try to bring along a common vision for the church?
Okay, Prof, I'm going to create injury time. 1 minute for you to respond.
First of all, the one about violence, the violence of Botko and the violence of MK, the difference is a very interesting one. It's a question to pursue. Violence under the sun, no instrument is perfect. I mean, also as revolutionaries and as people of morality and Christians, we cannot say is a perfect. There'll always be mistakes. And on the second question, a common vision was tried. There was a theme of reconciliation. There was a theme of trying to build a common South Africa. But the realities of today ask us, have we succeeded? How multiracial, how combined, how are our churches, and are the existential and revolutionary goals that are being pursued about bettering our people, are they commonly pursued by people who worship together on Sunday and the following, on Monday, they meet in the shopping malls? Are they the same people? Do they vote the same party? Do they have the same life? And then they go and pray together in the same church.
Prof. Lamola, on that note, thank you so much for your insights this morning.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure. Wonderful.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.